1490 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media
News
app.
I'm Lionel Moyes. The White House confirms President Biden has been briefed on the arrest of 21-year-old Jack Teixeira. The 21-year-old Massachusetts Air National Guardsman has been taken into custody in relation to leaked classified military documents on a gaming social site.
What authorities have alleged is that Jack Teixeira, going under a different username, an anonymous username, posted photos to that Discord server that was full of young men who were talking about video games, talking about a lot of different things. And then from that server is where this information gets posted broader, is the theory, to the larger internet, Twitter and other social media places.
ABC's Jay O'Brien. Attorney General Garland says the Justice Department will take the fight over abortion medication to the Supreme Court. Police in Virginia say the mother of a six-year-old who shot his teacher has been formally arrested on charges of child neglect and failing to secure her handgun. This is ABC News. The Biden administration has announced 9 bridge projects that will be overhauled in Michigan, D.C., California, New York, Wisconsin, South Carolina, Texas, Oregon, and Oklahoma. They'll share $300 million worth of infrastructure funds. Tulsa intensifying efforts to find descendants of the 1921 race massacre victims.
Using genetic analysis, forensics experts have come up with possible identities of 6 sets of human remains found in a local cemetery in Tulsa.
This is, we believe, the first time this has ever been done,
says Tulsa Mayor G.T. Bynum. The bodies may have been those of victims of the 1921 race massacre that's thought to have killed hundreds.
This is the part of the search that our experts cannot do on their own. They need your help.
Among the possible surnames determined by DNA, Holden, Larimore, Huntley, and Bohannon. The City of Tulsa website has a full listing. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
It's the end of an era in Chicago where Jonathan Toews is playing his last game with the Blackhawks. The team captain spent 15 seasons with the Hawks. Lionel Moyes, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Wisconsin is at risk for wildfires again today after a fire scorched about 83 acres of land near Nisida in central Wisconsin yesterday afternoon. People had to evacuate their homes and businesses. A wildfire at Fort McCoy forced Interstate 94 to close for a time. The Department of Natural Resources says nobody was hurt. The fire was contained by evening. It's not just wildfires threatening Wisconsin, there's a chance of flooding too. Fast melting snow is raising the chances of flooding on the Mississippi River. The National Weather Service says the chance for moderate flooding in Wisconsin next week is 80 to 90%. Chances of major flooding in some places is over 60%. In sports, the Brewers open a 4-game series at San Diego tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Grave Digger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram.
Saturday and Sunday at 1 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
And download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a new poll released today by the folks over at Demand Justice. And surprise, surprise, overwhelming support for Congress to spend a little time investigating these minor ethic violations that keep popping up at our Supreme Court with, at this moment, just one Supreme Court justice. But according to the most recent Hart Research poll conducted between the 4th and 7th of April, they show that 70% of the country, 70% of people are in favor of an investigation, just 19% oppose it. And again, this is just the beginning. When this poll was taken, all we knew is that Clarence went on a really half a million dollar vacation. Now we're finding out, so much more. And here to share some thoughts on, just how bad this is and maybe what we should be doing about it to get money out of our politics, to get money out of our Supreme Court. I've asked my good friend Morris Pearl to come share some thoughts. Morris is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires. PatrioticMillionaire.org is the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Great to be on your show.
So, I mean, this is... I'm almost speechless at how crazy this is. I mean, when it was a half a million dollar vacation on a yacht going to Indonesia, I go, okay, that's one thing. Maybe I need better friends because I've never had one take me on an all expense paid vacation. But now we see this story coming out that this billionaire bought Clarence's mother's house and half the neighborhood and. It sounds more than just a personal friendship.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think. I'm a, pretty fun-loving guy. I think if you out of every vacation I've taken my whole life, maybe you'll get something close to $500,000, but I doubt it. Yeah. And the thing is, Rick, even if Clarence Thomas never did anything wrong, did something for this guy, it's the appearance. It reduces confidence. It plays into the other side's theory that, everything's just corrupt and we're just a little bit more open about it than you are. And it's their basic message is they're telling the voters, they're telling the people, there's no hope. Politics, government, it's just completely corrupt. Just give up, go home, don't bother voting, and we'll just take over everything. And it's the same thing every time. And it's not even that, I don't know if Harlan Crow bribed anybody to do something, but he spent a lot of time with this guy. So he got to know a lot about Harlan Crow's concerns and his way of thinking.
Yep.
And what he thinks about things. He probably has not spent that much time learning about the concerns of, a typical guy who works for a living and drives a truck. It's just, I don't even think they realize it, that all of our politicians who spend all of their time with rich people who donate money, which I didn't know applied to Supreme Court justices until recently, it's that kind of access. And it's that kind of just, it permeates everything, sort of this understanding of, oh, how difficult it is to be rich and how inconvenient it is to pay taxes and that kind of thing. And it just makes people despair.
Yeah.
And that's what they want, I think.
No, absolutely. No, they want to. They want you to believe government can't do anything. It's broken. And look, they've done a great job breaking it. But you make an interesting point, because I had a friend who was a congressman for a number of years from Illinois. And he said, you know, because I asked him, I go, so how much to buy your vote? And it was a joke. I was asking him a joke. And he's like, no one's ever bought my vote. He said, but you can get my ear for 10, 15 minutes at a time, because I've got to spend all of my time raising money, asking people for money all the time. And that conversation usually goes, hey, I need some help with my campaign. And that person usually goes, well, you know, I got this problem. Maybe you can help with. And the more you hear about that, the more you are inclined. So I'm not thinking that this Harlan Crow has done anything illegal or wrong. But, you know, it's good to have friends.
They have a different way of thinking about things. In the mid-1980s, I was actually doing some work for like a high-tech temp agency kind of thing. A few friends of mine, we called it a consulting business. And it was, you know, we did temporary jobs for people. One of our clients was Trammell Crow, Harlan Crow's father, biggest real estate developer in Dallas. And to tell you the truth, I've been trying to think about it. I don't even remember what we did for the guy. But the one thing I remember him saying is that having a building with a mortgage is like selling your building to the bank and getting money. And then once a month, you have an option to buy it back for the next month if you want to. And not very many people think about a mortgage that way. Most people think about a mortgage as, oh, I have to make a payment every month or else the bank will, you know, foreclose on my house. But he thought of it as, oh, it's not my building at all, but I can buy it from the bank for a month at a time. And it's just a different way of thinking. I don't have any obligation to make good on this money that I promised. It's an option. I can think about whether I want to do it or not every single month.
No, that's a very big difference between, you know, rich people and poor people. Poor people really believe when they put their name on the line, that's an obligation. They've given their word. As my grandfather always said, you got two things in this world. You know, one of them is your word. You never break, well, either one of them. And I know, you know, the analogy, but you never break your word ever. And that doesn't usually apply. And I look at someone like Donald Trump, who's filed bankruptcy multiple times, stiffed people out of paying them multiple times. So you're right. It is different worlds.
He just thinks of it as, oh, me first. I forget mine. And then if I get everything I want, if there's something else left over, somebody else can have some. You know, it reminds me of when I worked in Ireland for a while, trying to figure out how much the bank crisis was costing them. And the Irish government, the prime minister, they call him the Taoiseach. It's one of the few Irish words I know. He felt that these banks owed all this money to these Germans, and the Irish government had to pay it back. They couldn't just tell the Germans, get lost. You know, the Icelandics did. But, I mean, it was just, they merged the government with the banks and ended up the government being pretty much bankrupt too. But it was just their way of thinking. Of course the taxpayers will make good on this money that our, you know, bank executives promised to pay. It's just a different way of thinking. And rich people just don't think they have any obligation to do anything. Maybe that's why they got rich in the first place.
Why this is important, Morris, and I'm glad you hit on this, is because having those kind of people on the Supreme Court making decisions for the majority of us, especially working people, because you look at the last, 10 years, there haven't been many decisions that have gone the way of working people. The pendulum swings too far out of whack, and you end up with the kind of anger and frustration that I think you see in our politics. You know, the number one response I get from people when I point this out, they go, yeah, what you said at the beginning, they're all corrupt, they're all no good, we should do away with all of them.
It's just frustrating. Because I think most people are actually trying to do a good job. I think most of our congresspeople, even the ones who I disagree with vehemently about taxes and wages and other things, I think a lot of them are honestly trying to do what they think is right. But there's just no chance, because this basic idea that, oh, this company's owed this money, this landlord is owed this money, of course the landlord has to be paid. Oh, the company needs money, of course the company has to be paid. Oh, the people need money to live on? Well, there's not enough money for that. And it's just a different way of, we're trying to change the way of thinking, to try to convince people, that's what our patriotic millionaire is all about, to try to explain to our representatives that they have to have a country filled with people who can afford to fulfill their basic needs and stuff. And that's their obligation too. Not just an obligation to businesses, not just an obligation to rich people to make sure they're okay, but they have an obligation to make sure that everybody is at least somewhat okay. And I don't think that's what we're getting from somebody like Clarence Thomas, who spends his time on $500,000 vacations and, you know, sells his real estate to, you know, Harlan Crow from Texas.
The amazing part of this is, you know, the story that broke, you know, here recently, that this guy bought up Clarence Thomas's mother's house and a couple of other places in the neighborhood, actually did a bunch of repairs to the house. You go, how does that go unnoticed? How does that go unreported? How does that go in our system where nobody pays attention to it? How does that fly under the radar? And then my other question is, how many other of our justices have similar kind of arrangements?
Well, I don't know the answer to either of those questions. Of course, there's nobody above a Supreme Court justice. So there's nobody to, like, supervise them. They're the top. And so, you know, somebody goes and sells a few houses in Georgia to somebody else. You know, who's paying any attention?
Yeah.
It's not like there's some watcher over of, you know, real estate transactions in Georgia necessarily. And, like, because Supreme Court justices, they do have lives too. They live someplace. They have houses. They have parents. They have kids. They pay their kids' college tuition. They go out to dinner. You know, they get sick. They go to the hospital. They do all the normal things that we do. It's just that in this particular case, this guy goes on vacations. Instead of, you know, taking his kids to Disney World in Orlando, he goes on a $500,000 trip to Indonesia. But, you know, it's the same general idea, I guess, from his point of view.
Yeah. But I don't know how you go on a $500,000 trip to Indonesia, make it $270,000 a year. Now, some would say maybe that's too little. I don't know. I know when Antonin Scalia was alive, he was always complaining that they weren't paid enough. And I got to wonder if that's part of this, you know, you keep them hungry enough to where they have to depend on their friends to lead the lifestyle that they want, if that isn't part of the system as well.
That is part of the other side's theory, is to do exactly that. You know, if you pay Congress people low enough, you're only going to get rich people going to Congress. Currently, right now, I believe about half of them are independently wealthy, and about half of them actually need the money they get paid as Congress people to live on. And, you know, it is a little bit more difficult living in two different places, spending a lot of time in Washington, a lot of time in their districts. And it's tough. I'm in favor of paying them enough money so they don't have to feel an obligation to do other things. You know, all these things, you know, every once in a while I get these questions like, oh, we should pay them the minimum wage and then they have an incentive to raise it. No. If you pay them the minimum wage, all the Katie Porters of the world would go back to teaching or doing something else, and you'd only have rich real estate developers in Congress, and they wouldn't give a twit about the minimum wage. And they don't care if they get paid anything. So it's just a completely different way of thinking. And we have to come up with some way that rich people don't have more access than everyday Americans. That's the thing. It's the access, I think. The same way, you know, someone can buy any congressman's time for 10 minutes for a few thousand dollars. I mean, I found myself, people call me all the time. And, you know, I got a message just today from a congressperson. Oh, we so value your insights. And, well, I mean, they probably value my money more than my insights, but they listen to my insights. And, you know, I occasionally do know something, I suppose. You know, as I said in my speech, you know, for a few tens of thousands of dollars, you can be anybody's best friend.
Yeah.
Maybe a few more dollars if it's Supreme Court justice, but
So to bring this back around and wrap it up, you know, what is the answer going forward? I mean, this is definitely going to tarnish John Roberts' legacy, because the Roberts Court is now going to be another scandal. We're never going to find out who leaked the Dobbs memo, or we're probably not going to get any accountability on this. What is the way forward?
Oh, and I don't care who leaked the Dobbs memo. You know, the original Roe v. Wade memo was leaked too. People forgot that a few decades later. I mean, sure, we should have standards for Supreme Court justices like we do for Congress people, and no taking gifts more than $100 or something. And, you know, but I mean, if there's no one to sort of watch over them, I don't know. Because you have to trust somebody. You have to trust your compliance officer or your ethics official, or your ethics committee, or your whoever it is that's in charge of monitoring these systems too. But there's no one to watch over the guy at the very top, and that's part of the problem.
There's nothing good here. Nothing good. Yeah. But Morris, I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff. Hope people will take a look at the website, patrioticmillionaires.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Morris Pearl, appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick.
Going to take a quick break, back with your thoughts. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, this Clarence Thomas thing, this has got to be infuriating. This has to make people angry. I mean, you know, it's one thing that, you know, the $500,000 vacation on the private yacht and all of that. That's one thing. But buying up mama's house, doing all the repairs, buying up, you know, stuff around the neighborhood, raising the property values. That's a whole nother bit of, it's a whole nother bit. Now for me, you know, you go, okay, well, there's this, trust me, there's a lot more. There's a lot more here. And as Morris said, look, you know, it's access. And this is why I've always, it's one of the reasons I started doing this show years ago. I remember, look, I would sit in union halls for years and have politicians come in and make all these promises. You know, they would say, we're going to do away with Taft-Hartley. We're going to pass a strike replacement bill. We're going to raise the minimum wage. We're going to strengthen unemployment insurance. We're going to strengthen the workers' comp. We're going to make, you know, fight for better, safer workplaces. We're going to do all these things. You know, Obama shook, I shook Obama's hand twice. Twice he looked me in the eye and said, we're going to get something better than the Employee Free Choice Act. And we got nothing. Wasn't even really pushed during his administration. And they had the time to do it and didn't. That's why, you know, Joe Biden to me is somebody who, look, they're trying to move some legislation. They're trying to do some things. But with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, good luck. That was our problem. And this, again, it all comes back to us. This is where my point is. All of this divisive stuff, when you boil it down, it comes down to access. Why is it that working people don't get the things that they need? Why is it our education system's underfunded? Why is it that healthcare is so expensive and difficult for working families to get? Why is it that we've got a real crisis coming? As Social Security is you know, they're starving that and trying to push it off and do more to make it harder for us to get. They destroyed the defined benefit pension years ago. You know, how is it that we never seem to get, as working people, the things that we need? And I keep saying, look, folks, this Supreme Court, this corporate court, is going to take us back to the days of the Lochner era. And I've talked about this numerous times. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I have read enough history to know not good. And for those who don't know, look up, you know, Joseph Lochner. Look up the 1905 Bake Shop Act. Look up the fact that, you know, New York State tried to put a maximum hour law into place. The Bake Shop Act of 05. And what happened out of that? You got a Supreme Court who said, no, you legal, you law people, you legislators, you government, you can't do that. You can't cap the number of hours. How dare you? Just like you can't make a minimum wage. You can't make any of this stuff. Stay out. And under the guise of liberty of contract, because, hey, if you working people are hungry enough, if you're desperate enough to work in deplorable and dangerous conditions, that's your right. It's your liberty. And no state official should do anything to protect you or put a floor under your feet. And I keep saying we're heading back to those days. They're moving us back to the days of Lochner. You ask any true understanding conservative, and they're going to tell you, yeah, the Lochner decision was wrongly decided. You know that whole West Coast versus Parrish, that was bad. Undoing the Lochner was terrible. It was bad for workers. Allowed them to join unions. Allowed them to push for laws, for maximum hour laws, child labor laws, minimum wage laws, safe working conditions, unemployment. All of the things that Democrats fought for and Republicans fought against. And Republicans are still fighting against. Look, if there was a major flip and Republicans said tomorrow, no, we believe in workers, you would see me voting for them. You would see me going, yeah, we want to make sure that families can put food on the table. If conservatives were true conservatives, instead of these, I don't even know what to call them anymore. People who tell me that they believe in smaller, less intrusive government, and that at every turn use government as a bludgeon against people that they don't like. But we're in this moment, and it's us. This is us. This is an us problem. All the things that happen in the halls of power are because we elect people to go there. We are a representative democracy. And who we, all of us, vote for when we go to the ballot box, that's who's representing us. And I look at some of the people who are there and I'm going, how? How is it that working people voted for this? We can, we could, we should, we must do better. Because here's the thing. You know, while we're talking about all of this divisive stuff, there are families struggling to put food on the table. There are kids that are going hungry. And one of the things I love about Joe Biden, you know, by 2030, he said, we're gonna make sure that no child goes to bed hungry. We're gonna end childhood hunger. And we can do that. Understand, we are the wealthiest country in the history of civilization at its wealthiest moment. We can do virtually anything we want to do if we put our minds to it. And right now, where are our minds? Enriching the very wealthy. Giving more power to the power already powerful. Why? Because they got friends. They got friends in the halls of power. Can you pick up the phone and call a congressman and say, you know, congresswoman, hey, I got a problem. Can you help? Do you think you can do that? Can you do it 2 days in a row? I know people who, you know, like Morris. Representatives need money. Politics run on cash. And for that campaign cash, he's got their ear. He's not buying their vote. And this is the same thing with Clarence Thomas. This Crow guy didn't buy him. Rented him a little bit. Didn't buy him. Keep them in the same world. Keep them desperate enough that they have to keep coming back and want to stay in the inner circle.
and you get what you want. Are we surprised by it? I'm not. But here's what I know. If you do away with government, if you do away with the courts, if you do away with everything like some want, and we privatize everything, then you have Elon Musk running things. You have a handful of billionaires controlling us. And I'll tell you, that not going to work out well. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1903. That was the day that 25 delegates from 17 cities gathered in Washington, D.C. to discuss forming a union for laborers. General laborers, who often perform some of the most backbreaking work on projects like digging canals and surfacing streets, were often blocked from joining craft unions as full members. The laborers in D.C. decided it was time to join together and formed the International Hod Carriers and Building Laborers Union. That was the beginning of the union that today is called the Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA. The union published its first constitution in English, German, and Italian, reflecting the diversity of the members that they represented. At the convention, the delegates issued a declaration of principles. In it, they declared, quote, "We hold that all men are created free and equal, and that honor and merit makes the man, and that self-preservation is the first law of nature, and that he who would be free must strike the first blow." They then went on to describe their purpose, writing, quote, "First, to gather under one grand banner all of those who toil on buildings with our craft and calling. Second, to promote by all honorable means the social and financial standing of all those who wish to partake in the fruits of amalgamation. Third, to create general agitation for the purpose of making a universal 8-hour day to increase the wages of members of the craft. Fourth, to establish a system of conciliation and arbitration in different sections of our land. Fifth, to help members of the craft in securing lawful and profitable employment. For more than a century, LIUNA has fought for the rights of laborers."
My city's daily newspaper has gotten so emaciated it should be in hospice care. Its front section is down to 6 pages, half of which are cheap ads, and nearly all of its articles are out-of-date, cut-and-paste pieces bought from out-of-state content providers. This embarrassment, put out by the Gannett chain of over 1,100 cadaverous papers, pretends to be the news source for Austin, a vibrant city of 1 million people and the capital of the second largest state in America. Gannett, owned by a multi-billion-dollar Japanese hedge fund, profits by buying up local papers, firing most of the news staff, raising prices, selling off the paper's assets, then killing the paper. If your town's publication is now a Gannett property, look to Salinas, California for its future. The 152-year-old Salinas Californian was this important region's main news artery until its new hedge fund owners started hacking. The paper was down to one reporter last December, but that lone journalist quit, and the Californian is now a newspaper without reporters, meaning no coverage of elections, city hall, sports, police, workplace issues, etc. The Salinas paper is technically alive, overseen until recently by another Gannett paper located 300 miles away. Now, says the chain's comically named Center for Community Journalism, Salinas residents can get their news by reading Gannett's national paper, USA Today. This is Jim Hightower saying, actually, Gannett's bosses are making major investments in themselves. CEO Mike Reed's salary this year is $8 million, and the global chain's owners will spend $100 million for a stock buyback scheme that will artificially jack up their own wealth. This is a blockbuster story of real news affecting real people and democracy itself. So how many Gannett newspapers do you guess are covering it?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you remember last year? Well, I guess it's been longer than last year. We had my good friend Andy Levin on the program. He was a congressman from Michigan, and he was heavily pushing for the staffers
on the Hill and Capitol Hill in D.C. to unionize. And I've been saying for years, it doesn't matter what you do for a living. You should have a contract. You should have your this job description, your what you have to do, how it has to be done, what you're paid, everything in a little book like I've got. A contract that is enforceable. And I'm thrilled to see that a number of offices in Washington, D.C. have organized and are beginning the unionization process to make those jobs, you know, accessible and living wage jobs with some dignity, some respect, that kind of stuff. That's why I've asked Courtney Lodick to come talk with us. Courtney's the vice president of organizing with the Congressional Workers Union. Congressionalworkersunion.org is the website. Courtney, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So I'm thrilled that you guys are doing so well. You know, when Andy suggested that this was going to happen, he told me about it before anything broke. I'm like, this is great. How many offices do you think you're going to get interests in? And you told me how many, 15 now you've got?
Yeah, 15 formally filed. And we also have 8 union elections we've won. Quite a few of those folks are now at the bargaining table. We have 4 more elections on the way. And to be honest, we have more interest in unions across offices than we've generally been able to even meet. So there's been tons of interest. And we also just recently in March went with our first Senate office. And Senate staff don't have the same rights as House staff because they're still behind on passing that same resolution that the House passed last year.
No, this is one of those moments. And I've been saying for a long time, you know, the fact that if you work for a living, you punch a clock and earn a paycheck, you should have some rights on the job. There should be dignity in that. And that only, in my view, comes with a contract, not the whim of an employer, which is why I think it's so important what you guys are doing. I remember at the time people saying that this was going to be, you know, just the Democrats are going to be saddled with this and Republicans are going to be able to do all of this other stuff. Do you find that argument reasonable? Do you find that as something that's going to happen? Or do you think, like I do, you know, empowering your staff to do the best they can is actually better than having them afraid to do anything?
Oh, definitely better to empower them. And I also think that the important thing here is a union is about having workplace democracy, right? It's about being able to have a say if you're a worker. And to me, it makes total sense that the people who work in these roles, who are the ones that are dealing with the agencies or writing the legislation and helping the member of Congress do their duty under the Constitution, know what working conditions work best for them. And an office could actually be more productive if we allowed those workers to be able to have a seat at the table and help make those decisions. And that's what this whole process is. And I think it's really telling that in the institution that's meant to uphold democracy, which is Congress, now we actually have, you know, some accountability for members to foster democracy in their own places. You know, Congress hasn't been a workplace that has been very democratic, funny enough. It's been pretty hierarchical. So I think certainly it's not just being saddled on the Democrats. I think there is something to be said here that union language is universal language. Everyone works in a job. It doesn't matter if you work for a conservative or a progressive. Everyone has basic working conditions that they should have, and they should be able to have a voice on the job. So our doors are open to anyone. And I think that this is just a testament that even though we work in a very partisan workplace, does not mean that unions themselves are partisan.
No, you're spot on. And that is an excellent answer. But I love your pinned tweet. I said a union isn't an outside organization that comes in to help you. A union is you and your colleagues coming together to empower each other as a collective. And trust me, that's way more powerful. And it is. I mean, the reality is if the workers can stand together and demand better wages, hours, conditions, the empowerment that they need, the job security that they should have, I think it's better for them, and I think it's better for the institutions as well. I do want to ask, though, because, you know, this is another one of those things that's fascinating to me, because you've got all of the Democrats who are saying, you know, we're pro-union. They get a lot of union support. I got to tell you, I thought that this would go a lot faster, being the fact that you've got all of these representatives who are out in front going, yeah, we're pro-union. But I look at Howard Schultz and Starbucks. A guy who I fear could have been labor secretary had Hillary Clinton won, doing what he did at Starbucks. It seems like words don't always match action, does it?
True, true. And while we've had a lot of members of Congress who've been supportive and have, you know, worked pretty well with their staff and trying to, you know, want to be agreeable with the union, there's certainly cases where that isn't true. And I also think that it's a lot of members of Congress are pro-union, but not a lot of members of Congress have been in a union or have organized or have been on that side. And so this is a totally new process for them. And it's a learning curve as well. And so I think that part of that delay is also this education that has to be had with the members themselves, but also even among congressional staff. You know, this is a workplace that is different. You know, it's not a workplace that's ever been unionized before. A lot of these are young workers, you know, coming from universities and coming from all 50 states. And a lot of those folks also don't know what it means to be in a union. And so I think there's education across the board that happens here. And I think we're certainly hoping that things start to speed up. I'll also say part of our delay is we have to go through the process of elections as part of our labor law, which is frustrating at best. But we've won every election that we've filed for. And I don't see us losing at this rate yet in any of the offices we have upcoming for elections. And I think that's really telling and super exciting.
Now, this would be, for me, you know, the idea of having a master contract across Congress would be, for me, the ideal situation, that everyone's on the same plane, earning, you know, wages, the same conditions, so that you're not pitted against one another, and that your work, your mission, your job is doing the best that you can possibly do for we the people. And I like the way you put it. It's an education process. I love the fact that the younger generation, because you said a lot of people are coming from universities, we're seeing a lot of organizing on university campuses. We're seeing a lot of organizing in places where young people are, and they're doing it outside of the traditional, you know, legacy unions, if you will. They're starting it on their own, which I think is incredibly impressive, and it gives me hope for the future.
Yeah, and I mean, Congressional Workers Union is an independent worker-led union. Prior to being involved in Congressional Workers Union, I had not myself been in a union. I grew up in a household. My mom was a teacher. She was union chair of her department. She was a high school teacher. My grandfather was a Teamster and a UAW member. So I had a lot of rank and file folks. But, you know, I didn't know what it took to organize a workplace or you know, how to file a union petition. And over the past year, I've learned and grown. And I think that is something that we need to be talking more about in the labor movement in regards to education and watching these grad workers sort of taking things by their own hands and building their own organizations is incredible. And I think we see that in some of the other worker-led efforts that are really making a lot of media and airwaves, like Starbucks workers and like Trader Joe's, because I think it's getting us back to the roots of what the labor movement's always been about, which is it's the workers who are making these demands. And it's just like my tweet. It is not an outside organization. It is the workers who understand best their workplace. It's really about giving those, like, just understanding the basics of, you know, unionizing, but allowing the workers to sort of set the course. And that's certainly in Congress what we've been doing with our workers and how we built Congressional Workers Union.
No, it's fantastic stuff. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Courtney Luddick. She's the Vice President of Organizing with the Congressional Workers Union. Congressionalworkersunion.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they're doing. And for our folks in Congress listening, this might be a good avenue. Maybe you contact Courtney and you begin organizing your workplace. Now, it's interesting that you brought up this idea of the workers organizing and doing it for themselves and you know, taking control of their workplaces, much different than the era that I moved into the labor movement in, which was very much a business unionism kind of. It's a service. It's like car insurance. If you ever get into trouble, I remember getting this all the time. If you ever get into trouble, you'll be grateful you have a union. Instead of saying, no, how do we make this better? How do we not have workers who have to, you know, go through what we've always gone through? How do we make lives better? Better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities. And that's what I find most encouraging coming from you and your generation and the younger workers who are saying, no, we're not putting up with the garbage our parents and our grandparents put up. We're going to forge our own path. I find that to be most encouraging.
Yeah. And I also think it's a lot about community. A lot of people are coming out of the pandemic. Workers are coming out of the pandemic They might have saw their community shrink in isolation. And folks are saying, I want to build a bigger sense of community. And anyone who has gone through the unionizing process, who's organized their workplaces, I think knows that there can be a super strong sense of building community in that process, of getting to know your coworkers and talking to them. Building your own union is, I think, a whole nother different sense of community, because you're getting to create what that community looks like. And I think that there's really a future here in taking this organizing and scaling it up and doing this sort of worker-led effort across the country and shifting back into what being in a union means, which is going to a union hall and having breakfast with your union members, and going to and hanging out with your colleagues after work and going to happy hour, you know, is not just about making the demands at the bargaining table. It's about the whole package. It's about the community, and it's about having, you know, a better workplace. I always like to say, you know, higher wages is something that gets people into wanting to unionize or wanting to join your union, but you stay for the community. You are committed to the organization for the community. And I think the labor movement has a lot of potential to start fostering that community once again. And there's an appetite for it, especially among young people.
Well, you're so spot on. And look, I've been screaming about this for years, because I look at the movement of my grandparents' generation, which is exactly what you were talking about. It was the heart of the community. It's where you had your weddings. It's where you had your funerals. It's where life happened. And then, the 80s happened, the 90s, and it was very much about business. It's transactional. I am thrilled to hear that there's a movement to get us back towards that kind of communal movement generated unionism that I think is so important. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, as you're talking to people, I guess I have two questions, and I'll save the last one because I'm going to save it. When you're talking to people, what is that sales pitch? I know when I was doing organizing, it was all about the wages. I go, this is, as a truck driver, this is what I earn. I get paid for this time, and I know you don't. The sales pitch is, we're going to make your economic lives better. We're going to make your family's lives better. You're going to get better health care. You're going to get better retirement security. That was the hardcore sell. What are you guys saying that this is the reason? I know you said community and all that. Walk me through some of it, if you would.
Yeah, I certainly think wages is something how you initiate the conversation, because everybody wants to get paid a little bit more. And certainly in Congress, where there are historically low wages, and for the folks who are living in the larger cities like Washington, D.C. or New York for their job working in Congress, it's very hard to pay your bills on the wages you're making when you're entry level. But I also think a huge thing we've saw is safety at work and telework, and that's coming out of the pandemic. There's still a concern for exposures, and because there has been, this more flexibility and being able to work from home, that's been better for younger people, but also for some of the parents who work on Hill, the young parents who work on the Hill, who would have otherwise left their job were it not for the flexibility of telework. And I think you have a lot of workers who want to keep that, and a lot of managers who want to go back to fully in person. And so I think that's been a huge grabber. And then as well, we can't look past the insurrection that happened in our workplace. And I think that was a huge catalyst for unionizing, because congressional workers were faced with a fear of our lives. And there wasn't a lot of protections that came after the insurrection for congressional staff. And so it was about coming and sort of taking things into our own hands and making our own demands. And I think that is really the language that is spoken to a lot of congressional staff. Everyone's had the experience of trying to go to your end of your review and ask your chief for, like, to make $30,000 instead of $25,000, and gotten denied. And so when we start talking about, well, wouldn't you feel way more comfortable making these demands if you were hand in hand with all the people you work next to, because you're more protected, and because they can't say no to 10 of you. They can't say no to the majority of their workforce. They need to listen to you. And I think it really comes down to this idea of telling collective stories. When I'm telling my story about why I need a like higher wage, or why I need telework, or why this job is hard, your manager can be like, well, that's just your own story. That's a one-off. But when we start telling our stories together, and we start weaving them in, and we start seeing the patterns, Congress members of Congress, your boss, whoever it is, they can't deny those things. They have to, you know, accept and recognize them. And our voices become so much louder. And that's certainly what happened last year when we were able to get our rights passed. And I think that is that sort of shared language when we're talking to congressional staff. You know, the working conditions are one thing, but it's really about the solidarity.
It's fabulous. Last question, kind of a side swipe. Who's been the a-hole? Anybody? Anybody giving you the Howard Schultz treatment? And who do we shame? Because we can start that tomorrow. We can start that right now.
I'm not at liberty to say. You know, for the most part, we're really getting staff trained up to go to the bargaining table. But, you know, certainly when the time comes and we need to make sure that members are more accountable, we'll make sure that happens. But like anything, you know, unionizing is strategic. And the goal here is to have a good working relationship between management and the union. And that's what we want.
Well, whoever that person is, I want to know, because I will be the spear that shames them. Because look, especially if you're a Democrat right now, you should be helping your workers organize. You should be out in front of this. That's just my view. But Courtney, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you. I wish you the best. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on.
Good stuff. Courtney Lodic. Make sure you check out their website, congressionalworkersunion.org. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a quick look at that. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around and listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top. Think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. Labor leader and socialist Eugene V. Debs was sent to prison for speaking out against World War I. Debs was a well-known figure. In 1894, he had led the American Railway Union out on a strike against the Pullman Railway Car Company. A quarter of a million railway workers walked off the job in support of the strike until it was brutally crushed by the United States military. Debs was arrested and served time in prison for his role in the strike. Due to his popularity, government officials were alarmed by Debs' pacifist stance. So, in 1917, when he gave a speech against World War I in Canton, Ohio, he was arrested under the Espionage Act. The act had been passed a few months prior, making it illegal to interfere with the armed services' recruitment efforts during wartime. At his trial at a federal court in Cleveland, Ohio, Debs defended himself. In his final statement, he explained his motivation. "I am thinking this morning of the men in the mills and the factories, of the men in the mines and on the railroads. I am thinking of the women who, for a paltry wage, are compelled to work out their barren lives, of the little children who, in this system, are robbed of their childhood." He was found guilty, and so, on this date, he started his 10-year sentence. In Cleveland, infuriated unionists and socialists led a protest of Debs' imprisonment. Violence broke out during the march. Mounted police and even tanks were brought in to suppress the demonstrators. In the aftermath, two people were killed, more were injured, and dozens were arrested. While in prison, Debs ran for president of the United States on the socialist ticket, receiving nearly 1 million votes. Finally, in 1921, President Harding commuted Debs' sentence to time served. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Got an email from Darren listening on KTRC in Santa Fe. Ask the question, and this is I get this sometimes, especially from new listeners. Why do you always beat up on Republicans? They're not always wrong. Look at some of the craziness coming out of the Democratic Party. I have looked at a lot of the craziness that comes out of the Democratic Party, and I have problems with the far left as I do with the far right. I'm a working class guy. For me, it's how do we make people's lives better? How are we going to move forward and make sure that people don't, you know, 39% of the people, you know, missing meals to put rent to pay their rent or their mortgage. How do we make sure that doesn't happen in the wealthiest country in the world at its wealthiest moment? How do we make sure that, you know, families don't have to file bankruptcy because a kid got sick? For me, this is the wheelhouse. But understand, all of these social cultural issues that are being used as a wedge, I have to be on the side of working people, especially working poor people, because what I know without question, and Darren, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but I know working class people are going to be the ones that take it on the chin. The wealthy, they're always going to get what they need. The wealthy are always going to be protected. The wealthy are always going to be safe. I come down on the side of pro-safety, whether it's abortion or any of the social issues. I come down on the side of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. As long as what you're doing doesn't directly affect me or somebody else, as long as you are living your life, I'm on your team. If you're oppressed, if you're kicked and beaten and downtrodden, and I'm there for you. You know, it goes back to something my high school government teacher said. You know, the reality is you have to decide which side you're on. You know, are you on the side of the wealthy or the poor? Are you on the side of the oppressors or the oppressed? And for me, I'm always fighting power. So when I see the kind of abuses, like in Missouri, that's going to make it virtually impossible for people to pursue their happiness by basically outlawing gender-affirming care, which, again, I don't understand. I'm going to stand with those people. You know, there was a speaker at the last AFL-CIO convention. They had a well in the middle, and people would get up and speak, and there was a transgender woman who stood up there and gave a really fiery speech. And, you know, there was nobody rah-rahing or any of that. People sat and listened, you know, and then they went on their way. And this person was upset that nobody, you know, reacted, because it was a fiery speech. And I said, you know, this is the wrong crowd for that speech. This is the crowd that's going to make sure that you don't get cheated out of wages. This is the crowd that makes sure at work you get equal treatment. This is the crowd that's going to, if you're in danger, they're going to stand with you. They're not going to be marching out in the streets, you know, with their behind hanging out or any of that. But if you've got danger, if you're being cheated, this is the crowd that will help stand up and defend you. And for me, that's what the labor movement is about. It's about making sure that we working people have some protection. And at least that's my view on it, Darren. So if you wonder, you know, why am I always talking about this? Because these attacks are real. Because I know once we're done with them, it's going to filter down to, well, somebody else. And I know that they're going to end up being, well, we're going to end up being used to be pitted against each other to ruin all of our lives. I want you to be happy. I want you to live your best life. I want life, liberty, pursuit of the happiness. I wholeheartedly. But more importantly, I go back to something my grandfather always said. He always said, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. We're a society right now that seems fixated on others. And we've got a Republican Party right now, Darren, who's fixated on other people's sex lives and other people, what's going on between their ears. And not so much looking inward. So, yeah, I'm going to talk about the attacks on transgender and LGBTQ and on women. I'm going to talk about it and on kids. And I'm also going to talk about the Republicans saying that they're in favor of 12-year-olds getting married. No, they can't dress up like a girl and dance, but they can get married to a 30-year-old guy? Show me the sanity in that. I appreciate the email. Thanks. Again, if you've got thoughts, questions, comments, I want to hear it, especially the angry stuff. Something I said got under your skin, by all means, shoot me an email at rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, the podcast is always there, always available, easy to grab, ready to go. Just wherever you get your favorite podcasts, you'll find ours. I appreciate you being here. Thanks so much. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News.